that is, you know, $5 is not a lot of money, but 5 times 88, because in Jamaica, a dollar is still a dollar. And, you know, you, when you go into the store, you're buying, what is it? You're buying rice, you're buying something, you know, cooking oil for 1,000 some other dollars, you know.
Mr. Selassie, I fear to tell you that we have to, in a sense, leave it there, but not leave it there, because you're going to close it out in just a few. Want to tell you that in your wonderful New York, to which you return later today, you say?
Yes.
It will be raining to greet you on your arrival. It will be approximately, well, they say certainly over Bed-Stuy, the region I'm using when I plugged this whole thing in. I mean, hey, we go all the time by what's the temperature at Central Park. So I'm centering New York to Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn now, and it's 43 degrees there as we speak, going up to 47 by noon. It'll be raining. It will be raining. I'm thinking it's about double that where you are right now. But yes, we're going up to that. Brother Jose Richards and a group of other concerned Jamaicans, they will be staging a demonstration in the vicinity of the Jamaican consulate. That's 767 3rd Avenue in New York, northeast corner of 48th Street and 3rd Avenue, this coming Thursday, March 18, 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. And that's in protest to the sale of Air Jamaica to foreign interests. And they're demanding that Prime Minister Bruce Golding consider the proposal of the Jamaican Pilot Association. And they want certainly the stopping of the government to selling out our patrimony to the foreign interest. One person to contact is Jose Richards. Just one person is 718-712-5034. That's 718-712-5034. And it's the 6th train to 51st Street is certainly how you make that hookup. Connections is on this Monday morning. Join me for that. That's 3 to 6 a.m. this Monday morning. And, well, we're getting ready to leave out of here, sir. Jim Freund is here, almost ready to go with R of the Wolf. And Simon Lokley comes up immediately after him. So if we do what we do normally, you do it.
Oh, you have been listening to Lavish. I am Hector Selassie. We'll be back next week with another edition of the program. Lavish is produced by Ian Forrest with assistance from Seduzo Karen Billy and Isa Jerry Azmat production. To build our love on one foundation, got to build our love on one foundation. There will never be, no love at all. There will never be no love at all. No!
together. We are birds of a feather. We got to come together, 'cause we are birds of a feather. We got to come together, 'cause we are birds of a feather. Or there will never be, Lord of mercy, no love at all. There will never be, yeah, yeah, no love at all. We also got to realize we are one people, yeah. Got to realize that we are one people, yeah. We got to realize we are one people, or there will never be no love at all.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a Saturday morning program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. With us this morning, I'm proud and pleased beyond all means to have Nora Jemison, or N.K. Jemison, if you like, author of The 100,000 Kingdoms, Nebula Award nominee. Oh, just stay tuned. Thank you. Oh, we're, I mean, you ought to be hearing what's going on off the air because, you know, we're having a great show. It just hasn't been on the radio yet. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica radio at 99.5 FM. And despite the fact that I feel like bleep, we're having a great time. I've had a horrible, horrible cold, which has kept me out of so many things in the last 2 weeks. I missed two memorials, one for David Nolan of WBAI in NYC, who died at age 48 a couple of weeks ago of a heart attack, and John Glideman, who's the husband of Margot Adler. And Margot, of course, created this radio show that you're currently listening to, Hour of the Wolf, and is the New York Bureau Chief for NPR, you know. Cool lady. And, you know, I missed that. And I missed a launch party for a book called The 100,000 Kingdoms. But I'm not missing this damn show because the author of The 100,000 Kingdoms is here. And I'm also not missing her reading this coming Wednesday at the KGB bar at 7 o'clock at 85 East 4th Street.
It is indeed at 7 o'clock, and it's the KGB bar.
So what you do is you go to 2nd Avenue and 4th Street, mm-hmm. and you start walking west, and you'll see the KGB bar in red. Of course, what color would the KGB bar be? Mm-hmm. Above this theater, and show up at 6:30 because it's going to be crowded. And I hereby predict. And also reading will be Michael Shea. Mm-hmm. And I will be interviewing Michael Shea, who's a Californian, before the reading. He and I are going to convene here, and then I'm going to bring him to the reading, is the promise. And that's going to be a lot of fun. Cool. But it's Nora's reading also. So, look, I'm getting how many shows out of it? Plus, I'm going to get the reading itself because I record them. And, oh, by the way, let me thank on the air, because I don't do it enough, Gordon Linsner. When I don't make it there, he records them for me. And there's hardly a word. I shoot him an email. He says yes. And then I see him at a Nursef reading, the evil competition to the KGB reading series. And he just comes in and he hands me the tape. And I don't even have a chance to thank him. So, you know, somebody write an email to Gordon and say, Jim thanked you on the radio.
I have this image in my head now of a KGB Nursef cage match.
Well, we have had serious
really?
Competition and problems. Yeah, especially when before Matt Kressel was the co-host, we had the co-producer, Gavin Grant, at one point.
Right, I remember.
And the curator for the Nursef readings at that time was Paul Witkover. And I was thinking Paul ought to do a reading himself. But then Paul was booked for KGB.
Mm-hmm. And that caused a huge problem.
Absolutely. Guess. So right. For revenge, I booked Gavin and Kelly Link.
Oh, no.
How's that for revenge? So you take my person, I take your person. In fact, gotcha. I take you yourself.
Gotcha.
Yeah, and then I did another thing with Datlow. That's revenge. Well, I got two good readings out of it.
That's true.
So, you know, and he only got
some
one good
bad
reading
blood,
out of
but
it.
You know.
Yeah, well, you know, at some point we ought to do like an altered fluid reading, because Matt hasn't done one, has he? So you see, that I'm going to take more revenge. I'm going to preempt him by taking him.
That would be fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the group would be up for it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It would probably have to be two readings because you. Mm-hmm. I don't like the pardon me, Ellen, the gangbang readings where you
That's
get.
That's horrible.
Well, you get eight people.
Right.
You know, and they get 5 minutes each. Mm-hmm. I'm into all the stories, although I'm currently working in something that you haven't heard about, but you're going to hear about.
Which is?
Black Vampire Stories.
Uh-huh.
At the last NIRSIF reading, we had L.A. Banks,
right?
Who is, you know, supreme in black vampire pop fiction. Mm-hmm. And in doing the intro, I said, well, Terrence Taylor is here and his novel is just coming out. And, oh, Elia Don Johnson, who's here, has a black vampire story coming out in May. Uh-huh. And, there's Linda Addison. Oh. And she's written vampire poetry.
I said, she was doing vampires. Okay.
Well, not doing, but she has. Because she writes about all horror kinds of things. She's more into the Caribbean mojo, voodoo kind of stuff. But believe me, she ain't turning down the designation of doing vampires. And I'm saying right here in this room now, we have four black vampire writers.
Mm-hmm.
And there's more. You've written a short story, haven't you?
Yeah, but I don't touch vampires.
Yeah.
I have a prejudice.
So at that time, Terrence and Cherie and I are now collaborating in email talking about a black vampire reading.
That should be interesting.
And Cherie apparently has the idea of, like, you know, six or eight readers or something.
Well, there's a lot more people that you could probably pull in.
Well, yeah, Cherie. Yeah, I mean, Cherie knows.
Joe Gomez and...
right.
Oh, goodness, I'm drawing blanks now. But, you know, there's a lot more black vampire writers out there, so...
And I know at least two Cubans.
Mm.
They're not black, though, but, hey, they're what we call third world.
Yeah.
You know, they're multicultural vampires.
That
How's
works
that?
Better.
Okay, that's what they are. And they're really great writers.
Yeah.
Really great writers. Of course, it's all set in Queens, actually.
Okay.
Well, that's where they grew up. They're Cuban. Their parents are Cuban. They're
first generation. Trying to wrap my head around a non-white vampire, because I'm not sure what they're writing.
Well, actually, that one writer.
Uh-huh.
Carlos Hernandez, who was on the air here with Delia Sherman.
He's in Interfictions, too. Interfictions reading, yes.
That's right.
Yes,
and
I heard his piece. It was fantastic.
He's wonderful.
Yeah.
He's a wonderful writer. Mm-hmm. He's doing more voodoo and actually not exactly voodoo, but Cuban magic
stuff.
Yeah.
It was a ghost story that he read, I recall.
His stuff is just... Well, in every sense of the word, fabulous. He's a fabulous writer and a fabulous writer. I never heard of him until he was sitting in the seat that you're sitting right now and reading on the air, which is one of the joys of doing this show and having other people bring me people. Which is sort of how I met you, through Altered Fluid.
That's true. Yeah.
You see?
I think I had just joined the group probably for about a month or maybe two when the first Altered Fluid reading happened on the air. So that was kind of my trial by fire.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so how much do you really want to be in this group? Get up at 3 a.m. and
oh yeah. Yeah, yeah. It's a real, yeah, really? Wanna... Yeah.
It's like amazing.
Altered Fluid is a writer's group. And what we do on this show approximately twice a year, if I had my druthers twice a year, and possibly I want to do, shall we say, spin-offs of that with people in the group, is they come here and read first drafts of stories, which are then criticized on the air by the group, which I think is one of the bravest thing for people to do, is because, you know, life's blood is in first drafts of stories. It could be totally rejected by your peers, and you know it's going to get rejected by editors because that's the nature. And those people who get through and get published, those lucky, lucky few, because there's a lot of great talent out there that submit and don't get published, and the discouragement of rejection letters. And great writers with great stories are constantly rejected.
Right.
But some people are fortunate enough to get their stories accepted. Some people are fortunate enough to get to sell a trilogy, and some are fortunate enough to have one of their stories nominated for a freaking Nebula Award. I can't get over this.
I can't either, actually, but I'm very happy. But
last time you were on the air with the group is, what, 2 months ago?
Yep.
And at that point, you were a somewhat published writer, and this point you have a novel and a Nebula Award nomination.
Things have changed a lot.
That's zero to 50. 60 is when you've won the Nebula. But this is true. Being a nominee is phenomenal.
Yeah. You know, they say that it's an honor to get nominated, and it really, really is. You know, what's interesting is that there's been a lot of discussion about the fact that this year's Nebula, because it had slightly different rules, may have had, you know, more diversity of age, of gender, of race, of, you know, just at one point.
For those of you watching your radios, Nora's black. Okay, so I just wanted to mention
Can you hear that?
The melanin tube in your radio
sound of
is
my
glowing.
Skin. I'm rubbing my hand for you now.
Yeah, we need melanin tubes, right?
But at one point,
By the way, Cherie Thomas sent me a picture of a black discovered in Antarctica.
Oh, I heard about that. The scientists are all shocked and amazed.
Yeah. At first I thought it was like a Photoshop thing.
No, there's some who are speculating that it might even be some kind of new evolutionary adaptation.
And I'm a penguin freak, and Cherie knew that. So she sent that to me, and she said, there's a black penguin. And I wrote her back saying, is this a political thing? And I'm sorry.
Go on. That's cute. No, but what I was going to say was at one point, one of my fellow nominees, Saladin Ahmed, is also on the...
Who also read his nominated story
on this show. He's also on the final ballot this year. But at one point, when he and I were sort of watching the Nebula tally, and it was as exciting as watching a horse race, but at one point, we were joking that it was looking like it was going to be me, Michael Burstein, and him, which would have meant Saladin is Arab, I'm a black woman, and Michael Burstein is an Orthodox Jew. So we were just kind of thinking to ourselves.
So black and an Arab and Orthodox Jew walk into an awards.
We were trying to think of a punchline for that joke, and we just could not.
Oh, I've got it. It's the old vaudeville thing.
Okay.
And here it is. An Orthodox Jew, a black woman, and an Arab walk into an awards meeting, and the master of ceremonies says, what, is this some kind of a joke?
That's a great one. That's perfect.
There you go.
Yeah, that works. That works.
Yes, Ken Gale of WBAI sort of shared that with me. And it's old, apparently. It's very old, but I didn't know it before. The other one is a blank walks into a bar and says, ouch.
Oh, no.
You can fill in the blank, you know. You fill in your own designation.
Right.
But so there's a punchline.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, I'll pass that one on to Saladin and see if we can use that one.
And Bruce.
And Michael, yeah.
Yeah. And let me point out, by the way, with Nora being on this morning, every one of those people have been on this show.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And a fourth nominee. I don't remember. Out of the six I've had. Oh,
Jim Kelly.
Jim Kelly.
I've
only had him on by tape.
I think I'm remembering correctly. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But of the six nominees, I've had four here.
Okay.
And of course, Rick Bowes is always here in spirit. So.
Right.
But he's novella this year.
Rick is everywhere. Rick is with us even now.
Rick is a great writer.
That's true. He is. And he's really been a great mentor for me since I came to New York, too.
Oh, has he?
Yeah. Cool. His mentoring consists.
Oh, so now we can add, you know, a gay man, right?
Okay.
Because that's identity politics, everybody.
Right,
that's true.
That's
what WBAI is
about. Oh, well, that's true. Yeah, Rick's mentoring consists mostly of snarky comments, but it's been very useful.
Rick has also always been my nominee for a radio show here in WBAI, but it's been a long path. We've done at least one tryout with him doing live radio.
Okay.
Going to do another.
Good.
Yeah, Rick doesn't know it yet, but...
Well, now you know, Rick, and knowing is half the battle.
But I have discussed it with the program director.
So. Okay, excellent. I think it'd be great.
I mean, you know, think about the way Rick talks at the KGB bar when he holds court. And, I mean, that would just be incredible radio.
I think so. Yeah, I would love to hear that.
Yeah.
Well, we'll put the peer pressure on him.
Yeah, I'm trying to get two people shows at this time. Okay. I won't mention the other.
Oh, okay.
But she's named after a Shakespeare play.
Oh, I know who that is.
Yes, okay.
Yes, I know exactly who that is. I think she'd be great, too.
Yes, she would. Mm-hmm. Yes, she would. She'd be, she'd fit in perfectly. Mm-hmm. She really would. Mm-hmm. Anyway, but we won't mention Tempest on the end.
That was real slick.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, real. In the honor of the way Margot started this show.
Mm-hmm.
I won't dominate, but you know, when Adler was doing this show, mm-hmm. she and I would sit together from like midnight to five talking and mm-hmm. stuff before, and she would say, "Freund, I'm going to tell you something, but if you ever tell anybody, it's like, you know, it's quits for us. We won't be friends anymore," or anything like that. And she'd tell me like this real intimate, in one case, fantasy about a particular baseball pitcher that was having. Uh-huh. And she said, "You can never say this. You can never, you know," right? Say, okay. And so she'd tell me this. And then later on, I'm engineering her show and she's telling the damn story on the air. You know,
it's like,
and uh-huh. I'm sworn to secrecy. I can't tell anybody, but she's done it on, right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So this is how I got trained, you understand.
Gotcha. Okay. So I'll just keep in mind that nothing is sacred.
Yeah.
Okay. Except the seven words.
Wait, and it's not the seven words.
Oh.
That's something that most people here, including our management, don't get.
Ah, okay.
The current FCC rules are much worse than that. They're about indecency.
Hmm.
So if you read something really, I mean, I had Pat Cadigan on the air some years ago.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And
I
she's wonderful. Mm-hmm. And I explained the seven words to her.
Mm-hmm.
And she was being, you know, brought in and mentored by Datlow, right? So we're having women's erotica kind of stuff on the shows, which is something else that you've written.
Mm-hmm.
And she... comes in, I explain the seven words.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't tell you what she read, but she read it. And it was just, she didn't use any of the seven words, but it was incredibly good softcore porn.
Wow.
Didn't use any of the words. She didn't have to. But, mm-hmm. you know, one word might have been, oh, let's say labia. You know, it's
mm-hmm.
like,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's not one of the seven words.
Right.
But what happens to that
mm-hmm.
word
was
in the context of that story? Hmm?
Was there any trouble?
I don't think the management was listening at 5 a.m., but...
okay.
And this is before... actually, now, our rules are much worse than they used to be. Our what's been going on here is there's no more safe harbor. Like, we could do seven words and profanity, not obscenity.
Mm.
Obscenity is illegal. But
okay.
we could do profanity up until 6 a.m.,
mm-hmm.
according to the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
But not according to Pacifica management, because one lawsuit, justified or not, would break the bank. I mean, the bank's already broken.
Gotcha.
And we have new terrible things happening right now, not because of Pacifica.
Mm-hmm.
But, for example, this show will no longer be available for 6 months, and it won't be available for download after the broadcast. It will be available for streaming for 10 days.
Okay.
This has to do with copyright laws. Music.
Because of the use of the music? Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Because of the use of the music.
Okay.
There are new rules
in
the Millennium Digital whatever that go into effect March 15th.
Mm-hmm. Well, I will have to correct that on my website because I'd mentioned that they could download.
Yeah, but what will happen is I will edit a copy of the show. I will take out the copyrighted music. And I think so far all the music I've played except for the intro is public domain.
Okay. All right.
Right?
That works.
And
as far as I know.
Yeah, it does. And then you can have a copy.
Excellent.
And
that's
you
great.
Can host the copy on your blog.
Oh, that's fantastic. Fantastic. That's
all we'll do.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
so...
I mean, there are ways around this, but I'm looking for a host, a online host for the archives of this show as a result.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because Pacifica
will not store it.
Cannot. Mm-hmm. There are things that I will accuse them of.
Right.
This is not one of them.
I see.
They are being correct, and I'm really annoyed.
Mm.
I mean, it doesn't matter to me, to the listener.
Right.
But I can re-edit the show.
And take out the copyrighted.
And take out the copyright material.
Yes. Domain, but copyrighted music.
Yeah. Right.
Okay.
Well, I mean, I can use Creative Commons music. I can use public domain music.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully I can talk to the people who do my intro and outro and get the web rights.
Mm. That's
all I need are web rights.
Okay.
Once I have internet streaming rights,
mm-hmm.
not download, but streaming.
Right. Then it's okay.
Then it's okay.
Okay.
I'll get around this. But I'm, boy, am I bleeped off.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're getting away from what we should be talking about. You. But enough about me. How long have you been writing? I'll go to my stock questions, you see.
Yeah, you know, I don't actually remember a time when I didn't write.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of my clearest memories was when I was like maybe 9 or 10 years old. And I was lying awake because I had seen some Disney movie that shall remain nameless because it's probably copyrighted. And I don't want them thinking that I
Well, you just saw
did
the movie.
Bad.
Is all right.
Well, I'm sorry?
All you did was watch the movie.
Yeah, I watched the movie, but then I you know, sort of laid awake in bed thinking of different ways I would have written that movie.
Ah.
It was proto-fanfic.
Right.
And I didn't actually write that. I ended up writing a different story that had nothing whatsoever to do with that, but that was kind of my first real memory of creating fiction in my head and realizing, you know, the urge is so powerful that I've got to do something about this.
Yeah, but a lot of good writers today, great writers today, mm-hmm. have come out of fanfic. Naomi
yeah.
Novik.
Yeah, yeah.
To name one.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Quite a few.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I wrote my first novel when I was about 10, and it was called something like Why Dogs and Cats Hate Each Other and Can't Talk.
Ooh.
Yeah, it was, you know, one of those existential titles.
Yeah.
And then there was a post-apocalyptic story in which the dogs and cats were like people. They had their own nations and they nuked each other and ended up being mutated by the nuclear blast, and it caused them to lose the ability to speak and reason and so forth. So, and it had something to do with some metaphor for can't we all just get along? And yeah, so I published it myself in a binding of cardboard wrapped in construction paper and bound with yarn. And that was my first publication.
Cool.
Yeah.
And when did you start submitting stories?
Short stories around 2002, a little later than 2002, maybe the end of 2002, early 2003. And I say specifically that because I went to the Viable Paradise writing workshop in the summer of 2002, which is a 1 week long workshop on Martha's Vineyard. I highly recommend it. It's like mini Clarion, essentially, for people that can't afford to take 6 weeks off work. 6 weeks off of work,
and wherever,
yeah,
Clarion may be held.
Yeah, and so I lived in Boston. This was in Martha's Vineyard. So I went to Viable Paradise for a week and spent that week. Viable Paradise, because it's not a full 6 weeks, does not concentrate really on craft, or at least it didn't in the time when I was there. What it concentrated on was taking writers who had the beginnings of craft and teaching them how to be good professionals, and how to make the transition from being amateur writers into professional writers. And then once you've made that transition, how not to torpedo your own career.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that I got out of it, and I got kind of bludgeoned with the idea, was that writing short stories was a really good idea. At the time, I had been very much a novelist, and I had been a bit of a novel snob, no less. I'd sort of decided that, you know, novels and short stories are very different art forms.
They
and,
are.
You know, I know how to do novels. I don't need to know how to do short stories because I don't want to write short stories, and, you know, recursive thinking. And what I remember is that Jim Kelly and Teresa Nielsen Hayden both sort of pulled me aside and said, you know, this sample you've submitted of the novel that I had submitted, it's good. We like this. But, you know, it's kind of long and wordy. And one of the things that writing short stories will help you learn is how to be concise. So, you know, I had been hearing different people say, learn to write short stories. Writing short stories can help you get recognized or noticed. Writing short stories can help you break in. And I just wasn't listening to any of that. But the idea that short stories could help me improve my novel writing clicked. And so at that point, I decided, okay, I'm going to get a subscription to FNSF. I'm going to, because I hadn't really been reading short stories either.
For people, by the way, who don't know, that's the magazine. That's okay. It's the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. When we're just talking, we know what we're saying.
Right.
But I figure there might be a cab driver or somebody out there who doesn't know what FNSF is.
Gotcha.
So I sometimes translate.
Right.
No. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, it's fine. So I got a subscription to that so that I could kind of get familiar with the current trends in short stories in the sci-fi fantasy field. And I joined a writing group, which was at the time called the Boston Area Science Fiction Writers and is now called the Brawlers, because we figured our name was too boring before. So,
That sounds like a Boston kind of.
Yeah, it was perfect. We don't remember what it stands for.
Rick
but
Bowes, again, would approve.
Okay.
The Boston and Rick.
The Boston Brawlers. And so that was actually a great group, and they sort of whipped me into shape over the course of several years, because I submitted my very first short stories to them, so they got to read the first long, meandering, angst-ridden horror that I provided them with, which was not meant to be a horror story. It was just horrible. And so they, you know, were like, okay, this is a good start.
Mm-hmm.
This is not right. And I went on from there, and my first short story sold in 2003.
Two?
That was... My first one was to an anthology that died, and I don't honestly even remember the name of it. So the anthology never came out. So I sold the story, and then a few months later, I got the sad notice from the editor that, oh, well, it's not going to happen.
Oh.
Got released, and that story sold to Idiomancer.
Huh.
And then another short story that I had actually sold prior to that one came out in Fishnet. So right around the same time, there were two short story publications. Fishnet is an erotica magazine,
mm-hmm.
and Idiomancer is a... now they're a little bit more slipstream focused, but they are an FNSF... I'm sorry, fantasy and science fiction magazine online.
Cool.
Mm-hmm.
But somewhere you still had the idea of novels.
I had never stopped writing novels. I wrote novels throughout my teenage years, and they were long, angst-ridden epics. Some of them never finished, but I'd finished probably five or six novels by that point.
They were just all terrible. How long was the idea of ascending the throne?
The one that came up in this?
Yes, in the 100,000 Kingdoms, published by...
Orbit.
Orbit Books.
As of February 2010, yes.
Right. Yes. Just thought I'd mention that in passing.
That particular idea had actually been written already by the time that I went to Viable Paradise.
Uh-huh.
It had been written as a very different novel, third person, and... Oh, you still have it.
Of course I have it. I treasure this.
It's probably the first autographed arc.
I may have been one of the first people ever
you
to get
You were my
it.
First autograph,
oh,
actually.
Look.
I'd never done an autograph before.
Okay, this is treasure. So what do you think? I still have it. Jesus.
Okay.
I mean, it's got eye marks over it from me and Barbara, but I still, but it's always going to be treasured. It's...
Oh, fantastic. Well,
and
so.
And by the way, it's a good book.
Oh, excellent. And the book that became the 100,000 Kingdoms.
It took me a long time to get around to reading it, but I did.
You have a lot of stuff to do, so I understand. But the book that became the 100,000 Kingdoms was written probably 5 or 6 years before Viable Paradise, but I could not sell it. I tried. I shopped it around to every publisher in New York that was willing to take unagented submissions, and it sat in a slush pile for 2 years at one point.
Wow.
Did not sell, and I have the rejection letter from that framed and sitting on my desk at home. And so I trunked it and then wrote another book, and that was what I submitted as a sample to the Viable Paradise people, and then went on and wrote another two books after that, and then finally went back and looked back at that trunked book and was like, you know, there's good bones here, but something is off, and I really wasn't sure what, so I just started randomly changing things. Like, it had been third person, I switched it to first, the protagonist at one point was actually male. I changed the protagonist from male to female. Now, I changed the story when I did that because I don't believe that you can just sort of substitute genders and still have the same story. And I wrote it over entirely from scratch.
It's a problem with some of the stories in the 70s where people were experimenting with that.
Well, you know, and those experiments weren't always a bad thing.
No, they weren't.
That wasn't
they
what
weren't.
I was. Yeah, that definitely wasn't what I was trying to do.
Yeah.
So, and because I had made so many changes, I did not just simply take the existing file and tweak it. I tossed the old file, started over from scratch entirely, and this was the result.
Mm-hmm. And this is, of course, I shouldn't say of course, but this is a fantasy trilogy.
Yes, the Inheritance trilogy.
Right.
And I've already gotten some zingers from people who are like, do you know that that's Christopher Paolini's? And I'm like, well, there's actually a science fiction trilogy called the Inheritance Trilogy 2 and a mystery trilogy called the Inheritance Trilogy. So it's not like I'm the first.
Right, it isn't. And it's actually, not on the arc. It's not on the cover. Is it on the
final? It is. It's on the arc.
The Inheritance Trilogy?
This line that says book one of the Inheritance Trilogy.
Of course, it's right there.
But this was taken off of the final version. I'm not sure why, but yeah.
Yeah, because the covers and arcs are often different, and they have marketing and promotion materials and stuff like that.
The image stayed the same, but the text changed a lot.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, and nice bookmarks, by the way.
Why, thank you.
I just found my bookmark. I mean, it's wonderful. It really is. I mean, for a debut novel and for all this stuff to be happening, it must be a bit of a whirlwind.
It is. The Nebula thing was actually really a surprise because I had been so fixated on the novel that I had not really paid much attention to the Nebula voting.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I knew that someone had nominated my short story, Non-Zero Probabilities. I knew someone
published
had...
in Clark's World
yes,
magazine.
Yes, published in Clark's
and
World
still
in
available
September.
Online.
Yep. But I knew that someone had nominated it, but I was just kind of like, yeah, I don't have a chance. And I went on with the promotional and preparation stuff for the novel release.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think it was maybe 2 weeks before the... it had risen to the top. My short story had risen to very near the top. I think I was just underneath Michael Burstein's I Remember the Future.
Yes.
But
performed on Hour of the Wolf.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, I wish I'd heard that.
I'm sure I can arrange that.
Thank you. That would be
and
wonderful.
It would have still been online if it wasn't for the rules just having changed.
I know.
Because my 6 months of my show just evaporated.
Oh.
And I don't have copies of
those. When did it happen? I mean,
Friday?
When was Thursday or Friday? I mean, when did he do the reading?
Oh, July.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah.
That one I've got.
Mm-hmm.
That one I've got. But a number of the shows from the last two
Lost.
Or 3 months.
Oh,
well, I can recover them. I can talk to the web person here.
Gotcha.
Who's very nice.
Okay.
You know, and mm-hmm. you know, just, you know, for me, you know, I'll be able to retrieve them from the server. But
Yeah. Well, I had risen to, you know, being in like something like second place, but I assumed I had no chance. You know, young CIFWA members coming in kind of hear all the legends and the horror stories about how the voting works, and it's a, you know, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours.
Mm-hmm.
Da, da, da. You hear about all these things, and you hear about how essentially there is a trend for people of a certain age, people who've been around for a while and so forth, them to get the nominations and the awards. And I'm like...
The more seasoned writers.
Right, understandably, because they've been around long enough to have built up a following, their names are well known.
And we should explain, the Hugo Awards are a fan award. And
they're
a popularity award given out by anybody who joins the World Convention. And all you have to do is pay a fee and you can vote.
Right.
The Nebulas are, you have to be an active member of Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America. And that means that you have to publish a certain amount of stories and then you can vote. I just heard from Nora with the rule changes. Now I can nominate, which I didn't realize. I'm an associate member because I'm not a writer, but I'm, you know, as a professional in the field. So I can't vote, but apparently now I can nominate. And so the thing about the Nebula Award, it's a peer award, as the Academy Awards are. It's given out, and I've always given it personally just that much more not credence, but coolness. You know, it's a peer award. And yeah, it's people saying, this is the best amongst us. It's not just this is the most popular.
Right, right.
But this is the best.
But there is still, any award has a popularity element.
It has to.
And so, you know, the way that it used to work was that if you had been around long enough to know more people in the industry, then you had a better chance. And yeah. I'm a newbie. I had not really been around that long. And so I figured, you know, okay, I'll just get bumped off. And then I saw Jim Kelly was like just below me in the list. I was like, ah, Jim's got it. I have no chance. And so, you know, then about 2 weeks beforehand or so, someone was like, you know, Nora, you're still up there. And I started paying attention. And I think it was the last 3 days or so of the Nebula voting, I started watching it obsessively. And then the last day was the horse race.
Everybody voted on the last day.
Yeah. And people were changing their votes. There was a lot
there
of...
There weren't that many votes.
Yeah.
In there. My problem with this year's voting, I do have a problem with the new structure, and my problem with it is what they used to do is they used to develop a long list.
I see.
And then and then
whittle that down.
Exactly.
And then whittle that down.
And so there would be like 20 nominees, and from that 20 you would end up with the six or so.
Yeah.
And they eliminated that interim step.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that what happens is, out of 1,500 eligible members, the person with the most votes in short story were how many? Like 30-something?
The number of votes, you mean?
The number of votes.
The top three got 22 votes each.
The top three were 22 votes each.
And
this is not criticism, obviously, of those stories.
Mm-hmm.
Because let me tell you, these are great stories. Mm-hmm. But 22 people out of 1,500 is not a wide sampling. And I believe, I don't know for a fact, I believe if you were to, in the past, if you take the top 20, and make that the long list, and then have a runoff for the short list, you get a much higher percentage of people voting because it's not this abstract name anybody, any story that you like, and so many things get one vote, two votes, six votes. Instead, you have, okay, these are the ones, everybody go out, you must read every one of these stories instead of telling us what was your favorite story of the year. Read all of these and choose the best of these. And then you'd get several hundred votes of 30 or 50.
There were several dozen one-vote stories. It was basically a cluster at the top that got in the 15s and 20, the teen and 20 range.
Right.
And then a whole slew of, you know, two votes, one vote. You know, the long list still happened. It was just... The whole process was streamlined.
Of the long list. Yeah.
Now, you know, that said, my suspicion is, and you know, I'm waiting to see if there's going to be any sort of analysis of the Nebula voting. But because it was online, because the online form was so streamlined to use,
which was very good.
Yeah, and because people got really engaged, there was the running tally. Was good sport.
It was.
You know, in some ways,
my partner and I were watching it daily.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, in some ways, I would say that the running tally is actually a bit of a problem too, because it, in some ways, encouraged people to, you know, like I could see, for example, that I had a chance, so I might be more likely to change one of my votes, you know, for myself to someone else. You know, a lot of people probably were changing their voting at the last minute.
Didn't you have like three votes? Weren't you allowed to nominate like three items?
No, you could nominate up to six.
Six.
Wait.
But you could nominate more than one.
It might have been five. But
you can nominate more than one.
It wasn't as many as you used to be able to nominate, but you could nominate more.
That's great. That's great to limit that. That's great.
And so, you know, what happened, I think, and the reason that the last day tally was such a horse race was because a lot of people were changing their votes.
Yeah. I think a lot of people who hadn't voted.
Right.
Were all of
started
a sudden
voting,
coming in.
Yeah, because those, they were getting excited about it.
And those are the people who would have probably appreciated getting a list of the 20 top stories
I don't know.
And then,
yeah.
And then they're told,
yeah.
Read this.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And they're going to read the story that they otherwise might not have been exposed to.
Right.
And I think that that would work,
mm-hmm.
because that would encourage people to vote for the kinds of folk, mm-hmm. like you and Saladin Ahmed.
Yeah.
And let me remind listeners that our guest is N.K. Jemisin this morning. And I think that you would still be in there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that you would still make it.
Hmm.
But I think everybody would have been forced to read all the other top runners. And I think some of those don't get voted on simply because maybe their publication was more obscure.
Well, no, because along with the streamlined form, the CIFWA board also created a closed forum in which any of the Nebula
stories were available. Yeah,
yeah, anybody that wanted to could post their story, and it would be, you know, many of them got permission to repost print volume stories.
What you say is true. I might be wrong.
Yeah, so, I mean, you could see, especially for the top contenders, you could read those stories. Yeah.
I mean, I don't know that I'm wrong, but perhaps mm-hmm. what I'm objecting to is answered.
Hmm.
Maybe.
Yeah, I don't know if it was everyone that did it, but I know that all the top candidates, you could find their stories in that form.
But what has happened is all of a sudden the awards, certainly in the shorter fiction, I'm not sure if this is as true in the longer, in the novel
mm-hmm.
category and all that, but in the short mm-hmm. fiction, which is my favorite category,
mm-hmm.
Because I am a short story fan,
mm-hmm.
It has all of a sudden changed. There is a sea change
yes.
in who can be seen, who is
yes.
a nominee.
And some of that possibly also has to do with the fact that the associate members could vote.
You see, so, I didn't know that. I should have voted. I didn't vote.
I wish you had. I could have used another vote.
Yeah.
Nothing wrong with that.
You would have
I'm greedy
it.
Enough
I
to want more.
You. And Saladin would have gotten it.
Yeah.
Well, and one I other mean, person would have gotten it.
The associate members are people who have sold one story to a CIFWA qualifying market.
Mm-hmm.
CIFWA's basically got, for those who don't know, CIFWA has a list of markets that are acceptable to send fiction to, and these are markets that are known to pay
because self-publishing a story on the web.
Right. Right. And these are markets that pay pro rates or they have a certain circulation, da 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 da. And so once you've sold one story to one of these markets, then you can become an associate member. Also affiliates, I think.
Wait, am I an associate or an affiliate?
You might be an affiliate.
I might be an affiliate. That might be the difference.
Yeah, affiliates are people who...
Like publishers?
Or radio people. Right, exactly. People who are not necessarily
three
writers.
Of us?
Well,
there's me,
yeah,
Howard Margolin, and Dave Rahm, and
right.
I think we've just listed
editors
the...
And so forth.
But,
yeah, editors,
and,
too.
Yeah, and you see, I see myself mm-hmm. as equivalent of an editor,
mm-hmm.
because this show is a publication.
Yeah. Well,
I choose who.
I would agree.
I've had people
it's an
come
anthology.
On this. It is. Mm-hmm. I've had people who they say, "Well, I haven't published anything. Can I come on your show?" Mm-hmm. I say, "Once you've come on the show, you have, in essence, published.
Uh-huh.
This is a platform.
Uh-huh.
This is a professional. Right. I don't
right.
pay,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
but it is an edited
right.
thing by the sheer fact that I choose the people who come on."
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We're going to do a very cool show in April, by the way, with a woman whose name escapes me. It's an Indian name, so it's not...
Vandana Singh?
No, Sunumu...
Ooh, Sumana.
Sumana.
Yes, she's going to kill
her.
Me. Harihara Sawara.
That's it.
Yes,
she was
in one of my other writing groups.
Ah,
yes,
okay.
Yes,
well,
I know Sumana.
Okay, quick story.
Her husband was, and I knew her through... Well, okay, anyway.
Okay, I got an email earlier this week asking to add this person to the... New York Review of Science Fiction Readings mailing list.
Oh,
and there was
okay.
a little thing on the bottom that had like a brainwave or something .net
mm-hmm.
at the bottom. And I clicked on it and I mm-hmm. looked and I thought, oh, this is cool. It's like a Linux programmer and obviously a very neat person. And I like what she writes about and
mm-hmm.
all that. And she had an online book.
Mm. Thought Crime Experiments?
Thought Crime Experiments.
Yes.
And
their
so,
anthology.
And so I wrote her a yes, you're on the mailing list now email,
mm-hmm.
and I signed it Jim Freund, producer, Hour of the Wolf.
Uh-huh.
I seeded it. Uh-huh. And sure enough, my evil plan worked because Thursday, then I got an email saying, hi, I've got an ebook out called Thought Time Experiments. Would you be? And you know, I wrote back in a word, yes. Because because if she hadn't written me, I might have written her.
Well, she's great. I was on a panel with her at WISCON about that.
The ebook
anthology.
Is wonderful.
Yeah, it is.
It really is. Mm-hmm. And the way of publishing it, she and her co-editor Leonard, is that her husband?
Yeah, he's her husband.
I figured there was a connection between the two. Leonard, but as far as the anthology is concerned, yeah. And everybody tune in. I think we're going to go April 10th.
Ah, excellent.
But that hasn't been confirmed. I mean, this is happening right now in email. Okay, it's all just going on, and I'm just very pleased by this.
Fantastic.
And so, what is professional publication? She is. I don't care that it's just web. Everything she's doing
is professional.
It absolutely is.
Exactly.
And yet, it's a different kind of publication, and her husband wrote in an appendix on the book that they were trying to follow the format of the Whole Earth Catalog on how that was published and everything. They have a graph of all their economics and the realities of publishing. I just thought this is cool beyond belief. And perfect for Hour of the Wolf. So. And this is probably the first she's hearing of it, and I don't think she's ever heard the show, but hey, I'm looking for... Anyway... But that was in keeping
with the idea.
With the idea and what you were saying about the awards and all that.
So that kind of thing made a huge difference this year. The fact that, I don't know about affiliates, but the fact that associates
could vote. I probably can't vote, which is why I probably...
Yeah, you know, I may be mistaking associates.
No, I'm probably making a mistake. Believe me, I do it all the time.
Yeah.
Associate, affiliate, it's, you know.
Yeah.
It's, but what I am is I'm the equivalent of an editor, as far as CIFWA is concerned. And so, in other words, I can be there, I can lurk, I can talk, but I can't vote.
Okay.
And I believe that is correct.
Okay.
That I can't vote. And it's actually sort of just editors voting on their own clients, agents.
Yeah.
Agents would also be in my category.
And they had a rule this year saying that you could not nominate yourself. So that was another issue. all of these things.
I don't know if I agree with that one.
Well, you can vote for yourself if you make it onto the final ballot, as I discovered. Because I will shamelessly admit that I voted for myself. The idea was that, and I can kind of agree with that. The idea is that if this is meant to be a award from among peers, then you want to be nominated by your peers, not by yourself.
That's true.
So, you know, I respect
because
that.
Because it is a prestige award. Mm-hmm. It really is. And, you know, all awards have the politics inherent in the way they work.
Right.
But for me, the bottom line is, this is cool. I am so bleeping happy for you.
I'm excited.
Yeah,
I'm crazy.
You have every
excited.
Right to be. You have a career now.
Yeah.
I predict you're going to be able to make a living in what you want to do. And how many people?
Fingers crossed.
How many people have such an opportunity? I mean, of course, the realities of being a writer, especially short story writers, are you know, what do you get paid? $100 a story if you're lucky.
Right. Well, I mean
You've got a trilogy out.
Yeah, and being on the Nebula final ballot and, you know, dare I hope that I actually win, but being on the final ballot gives you bragging rights and gives you attention. You know, I've gotten, you know, even though the book has come out, the book has gotten good reviews, the book being The 100,000 Kingdoms, First of the Inheritance Trilogy.
Published by Orbit Books. Available now at your favorite bookstore.
But, you know, even though the book has gotten... really positive buzz, and I'm really just kind of humbled and amazed by the buzz that the book has gotten. There's been that much more buzz because of the Nebula nom, and people who probably would not have paid attention to this book because it's epic fantasy, because it's got some romance elements, because it's got girl cooties all over it, whatever. And, you know, people who would not have paid attention to this because of that take me more seriously now because of the Nebula nom. So it's helping. And, you know, and the timing was perfect. Not that I arranged it that way.
Yeah, the only thing that can sometimes turn me off are when things are, like, very, very slick, you know?
What do you mean?
Oh, something like this.
My mother was an heiress of the RNA, the family that rules the world. Even the gods have fallen into their power. And now, so
from debut author N.K. Jemisin comes a stunning epic fantasy novel of intrigue, betrayal, and dark beauty. The 100,000 Kingdoms is provocative and exciting, says author Kate Elliott. An extraordinary world, says author Carol Berg. The 100,000 Kingdoms, out February 25th, from Orbit Books.
Well, it's not that slick, but it's sort of like, well, I mean, first of all, when it's for somebody you know, it's way cool, you know.
Yeah.
That's book trailers, something that didn't exist 10 years ago.
Well, and mine is an audio trailer specifically. There is no visual component.
Right.
That's mostly because I've seen lots of book trailers, and only a few of them have ever really worked for me. And I remember the ones that work.
Yeah, see, that's my problem. I'm prejudiced against book trailers. Because
it doesn't make sense to do a trailer when you really think about it, because you're trying to translate text into a film medium. These are very different art forms. That doesn't make sense.
Although spoken word is legit in my mind.
Yeah, and so the audio trailer did not feel as off an idea for me. So, you know, I had a friend who is actually, she does a podcast, the Nitwitch Sci-Fi Fantasy Zone.
Oh, that's wonderful.
The Nitwitch is also
is
a
radio
producer.
Is that N-I-T or K-N-I-T?
K-N-I-T.
N-I-T-W-I-T-C-H.
Yes.
Oh, cool.
But she's
I
also,
like that.
I'm sorry?
I said I like it. That's
yeah. And she's also a professional radio producer. So, you know, when this whole thing, you know, with the book sale, book deal happened, I, you know, started thinking about ways that I could promote myself in more interesting ways or more creative ways or just not making the same mistakes that I had seen other people make. And I had no money, so I couldn't hire somebody to do a video trailer that would look really great or slick or whatever.
Yeah.
So, and I didn't want to do, you know, kind of a not so great job of the video trailer. So I thought, all right.
That was very professional.
And I asked, and I had heard her, she did the reading for one of my short stories that ran on
Escape
Pod Castle or Escape Pod? Escape Pod. Cloud Dragon Sky.
She I heard that. That was,
oh, you
yeah,
did.
That was
yes,
on
yes.
Escape Pod.
That was her voice.
Okay.
And so she did the reading for that, and I had fallen in love with her voice, and I was like, that's Yena.
That was a good reading. That was a good reading.
Yeah, she's fantastic. So I asked her, you know, can you help me out? I don't have a lot of money, but I'll pay you something, because I believe, you know, in paying artists for work, and I felt like she was an artist. And we worked together, and I sent her a sort of script, and she, you know, explained that, no, this is not how it works. And then she helped me rewrite the script.
Very
and
cool.
Yeah. So
and
that
you're,
was the
and
result.
And you're very lucky because sometimes publishers will just take this thing in hand and the author has nothing to say about it.
Well, you know, I sent this to the folks at Orbit and I said, you know, before I release this, how do you feel about this? Are you okay with it? They listened and they liked it. They've put it up on the Orbit website. So, you know, they're very supportive.
And Orbit is a cool company. Mm-hmm. They have been, you know, back when, what was their name 10 years ago?
I don't know.
Yeah, but they've always been, who's the editor?
Well,
who's in charge of?
The publisher is Tim Holman.
Right.
But Orbit itself is a UK company that's kind of homesteading here in the U.S.,
right.
if I understand it correctly.
Yeah.
I don't know
much about them other than I see the imprint and I like what I see.
Yeah, me too.
And they're doing things that not everybody does.
They're willing to try kind of interesting new things. In fact, we
and they're looking
ran
for new
that
writers.
On several podcasts. So it's been, you know, an interesting way to kind of get that out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you see, the difference between all these other people, and this is something I'm going to have a panel on with Neil Clark at Lunacon in a couple of weeks, is people like Neil Clark and the Escape Pod folk and all that, like the professional actor reading.
Right.
I have decided that my imprimatur in this world, which is largely what I've been doing outside of the fact that I used to read so many stories on the air,
mm-hmm.
And I'm not bad at it, if I say so myself, mm-hmm. but I do something that most people don't. I have the author's voice.
Mm-hmm.
I like to hear authors mm-hmm. read, which brings us...
Real slick. Okay.
Thank you. It's called a segue.
Right.
Do you want a cut of music before we read for a breather?
Up to you. Sure, whichever.
Okay. So do you want the other piece after, or should we do a little bit now?
It's a fairly long piece. So...
Yeah, but we can fade or
okay.
even start or however you like.
All right. Then why don't you start the song that is in the background of the trailer, which is actually an open source piece by an artist named Manolo Camp. Oh,
very cool. It's playing now, you see.
Yeah, okay.
And we'll listen to some of this, and we'll be back with Hour of the Wolf and N.K. Jemison in just a couple of minutes. You're tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI at 99.5 FM and at WBAI.org, and for a week or so at stream.WBAI.org. And the program's Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. With me this morning, novelist and short story writer N.K. Jemison. That's J-E-M-I. S-I-N. Get those correctly when you Google it. Or Nora Jemison, if you like. Mm. And you can find her also at Epiphany.
It's just nkjemison.com.
Oh, it's nkjemison.com.
Yep. The
name of the site is Epiphany, but it's
NJ Jemison.
Wow, my brain is mush. NK Jemison, my God.
It's actually okay. Freund. People have been mutilating my name for the last 3 weeks now.
On the air?
Everywhere.
No,
everywhere.
It's not right.
Yeah,
for
the
me
number
to do
of
that.
Different
it's
spellings.
Not like I've just
seen
met
is,
you, you know.
Yeah, people have been picking, you know, the first two initials basically as whatever initials they
we want. Have on the air the wonderful Nora Jemison, okay?
That works.
And,
sorry.
And she is going to read for you.
This is from the 100,000 Kingdoms, Chapter 1, Grandfather. I am not as I once was. They have done this to me, broken me open and torn out my heart. I do not know who I am anymore. I must try to remember. My people tell stories of the night I was born. They say my mother crossed her legs in the middle of labor and fought with all her strength not to release me into the world. I was born anyhow, of course. Nature cannot be denied. Yet it does not surprise me that she tried. My mother was an heiress of the Aramari. There was a ball for the lesser nobility, the sort of thing that happens once a decade as a backhanded sop to their self-esteem. My father dared to ask my mother to dance. She deigned to consent. I have often wondered what he said and did that night to make her fall in love with him so powerfully, for she eventually abdicated her position to be with him. It is the stuff of great tales, yes, very romantic. In the tales, such a couple lives happily ever after. The tales do not say what happens when the most powerful family in the world is offended in the process. But I forget myself. Who was I again? Ah, yes. My name is Yena. In my people's way, I am Yena Daoshe Keneth Taiwur Samim Kanadare, which means that I am the daughter of Keneth, and that my tribe within the Dari people is called Somem. Tribes mean little to us these days, though before the gods' war, they were more important. I am 19 years old. I also am, or was, the chieftain of my people, called Enu. In the Aramari way, which is the way of the Amun race from whom they originated, I am the Baroness Yena Dar. 1 month after my mother died, I received a message from my grandfather, Dakarta Aramari, inviting me to visit the family seat. Because one does not refuse an invitation from the Aramari, I set forth. It took the better part of 3 months to travel from the high north continent to Senem, across the Repentant Sea. Despite Dar's relative poverty, I traveled in style the whole way, first by palanquin and ocean vessel, and finally by chauffeured horse coach. This was not my choice. The Dare Warriors Council, which rather desperately hoped that I might restore us to the Aramari's good graces, thought that this extravagance would help. It is well known that Amun respect displays of wealth. Thus arrayed, I arrived at my destination on the cusp of the winter solstice. And as the driver stopped the coach on a hill outside the city, ostensibly to water the horses, but more likely because he was a local and liked to watch the foreigners gawk, I got my first glimpse of the 100,000 Kingdoms' heart. There is a rose that is famous in High North. This is not a digression. It is called the altar skirt rose. Not only do its petals unfold in a radiance of pearled white, but frequently it grows an incomplete secondary flower about the base of its stem. In its most prized form, the altar skirt grows a layer of overlarge petals that drape the ground. The two bloom in tandem, seed-bearing head and skirt, glory above and below. This was the city called Sky. On the ground, sprawling over a small mountain or an oversized hill, a circle of high walls, mounting tiers of buildings, all resplendent in white, per Aramari decree. Above the city, smaller but brighter, the pearl of its tiers occasionally obscured by scuds of cloud, was the palace, also called Sky and perhaps more deserving of the name. I knew the column was there, the impossibly thin column that supported such a massive structure, but from that distance I couldn't see it. Palace floated above city, linked in spirit, both so unearthly in their beauty that I held my breath at the sight. The Alter Skirt Rose is priceless because of the difficulty of producing it. The most famous lines are heavily inbred. It originated as a deformity that some savvy breeder deemed useful. The primary flower's scent, sweet to us, is apparently repugnant to insects. These roses must be pollinated by hand. The secondary flower saps nutrients crucial for the plant's fertility. Seeds are rare, and for every one that grows into a perfect Alter Skirt, 10 others become plants that must be destroyed for their hideousness. Okay, I'm going to skip just a small bit here. Yaina arrives at the palace and finds out that her grandfather actually isn't there, and she gets sent to the consortium, the Nobles Consortium, which is basically like Congress for this world, where she gets her first glimpse of her grandfather. Then after that, she gets sent to Sky again. I knelt before my grandfather with my head bowed, hearing titters of laughter. No, wait. There were three gods once. Only three, I mean. Now there are dozens, perhaps hundreds. They breed like rabbits. But once there were only three, most powerful and glorious of all, the god of day, the god of night, and the goddess of twilight and dawn. Or light and darkness in the shades between. Or order, chaos, and balance. None of that is important because one of them died, the other might as well have, and the last is the only one who matters anymore. The Aramari get their power from this remaining god. He is called the Sky Father, Bright Etempus, and the ancestors of the Aramari were his most devoted priests. He rewarded them by giving them a weapon so mighty that no army could stand against it. They used this weapons, really, to make themselves rulers of the world. That's better. Now. I knelt before my grandfather with my head bowed and my knife laid on the floor. We were in Sky, having transferred there following the consortium session via the magic of the vertical gate. Immediately upon arrival, I had been summoned to my grandfather's audience chamber, which felt much like a throne room. The chamber was roughly circular because circles are sacred to Etempus. The vaulted ceiling made the members of the court look taller, unnecessarily, since Amun are a tall people compared to my own. Tall and pale and endlessly poised, like statues of human beings rather than real flesh and blood. Most High Lord Aramari, I said, I am honored to be in your presence. I had heard titters of laughter when I entered the room. Now they sounded again, muffled by fans and kerchiefs and hands. I was reminded of bird flocks roosting in a forest canopy. Before me sat Dakarta Aramari, uncrowned king of the world. He was old, perhaps the oldest man I have ever seen, though Amun usually live longer than my people, so this was not surprising. His thin hair had gone completely white, and he was so gaunt and stooped that the elevated stone chair on which he sat, it was never called a throne, seemed to swallow him whole. Granddaughter, he said, and the titter stopped. The silence was heavy enough to hold in my hand. He was head of the Aramari family, and his word was law. No one had expected him to acknowledge me as kin, least of all myself. Stand, he said. Let me have a look at you. I did, reclaiming my knife since no one had taken it. There was more silence. I am not very interesting to look at. It might have been different if I had gotten the traits of my two peoples in a better combination. Amun height with Dari curves, perhaps, or thick, straight Dari hair, colored Amun pale. I have Amun eyes, faded green in color, more unnerving than pretty. Otherwise, I am short and flat and brown as forest wood, and my hair is a curled mess. Because I find it unmanageable otherwise, I wear it short. I am sometimes mistaken for a boy. As the silence wore on, I saw Dakarta frown. There was an odd sort of marking on his forehead, I noticed, a perfect circle of black, as if someone had dipped a coin in ink and pressed it to his flesh. On either side of this was a thick chevron bracketing the circle. "You look nothing like her," he said at last. "But I suppose that is just as well. Varane?" This last was directed at a man who stood among the courtiers closest to the throne. For an instant I thought he was another elder, then I realized my error. Though his hair was stark white, he was only somewhere in his fourth decade. He, too, bore a forehead mark, though his was less elaborate than Descartes's, just the black circle. "She's not hopeless," he said, folding his arms. "Nothing to be done about her looks. I doubt even makeup will help. But put her in civilized attire, and she can convey nobility, at least." His eyes narrowed, taking me apart by degrees. My best Doran clothing, a long vest of white civet fur and calf-length leggings, earned me a sigh. He examined my face so long that I wondered if I should show my teeth. Instead, he smiled, showing his. "Her mother has trained her. Look how she shows no fear or resentment even now." "She will do, then," said Descartes. "Do for what, grandfather?" I asked. The weight in the room grew heavier, expectant, though he had already named me granddaughter. There was a certain risk involved in my daring to address him the same familiar way, of course. Powerful men are touchy over odd things. But my mother had indeed trained me well, and I knew it was worth the risk to establish myself in the court's eyes. Descartes Aramary's face did not change. I could not read it. "For my heir, granddaughter, I intend to name you to that position today." The silence turned to stone, as hard as my grandfather's chair. I thought he might be joking, but no one laughed. That was what made me believe him at last, the utter shock and horror on the faces of the courtiers as they stared at their lord, except the one called Verain. He watched me. It came to me that some response was expected. "You already have heirs," I said. "Not as diplomatic as she could be," Verain said in a dry tone. Descartes ignored this. "It is true there are two other candidates," he said to me. "My niece and nephew, Samina and Rolade. Your cousins once removed." I had heard of them, of course. Everyone had. Rumor constantly made one or the other heir, though no one knew for certain which. Both was something that had not occurred to me. "If I may suggest, grandfather," I said, carefully, though it was impossible to be careful in this conversation, "I would make two heirs too many." It was the eyes that made Descartes seem so old, I would realize later. I had no idea what color they had originally been. Age had bleached and filmed them to near white. There were lifetimes in those eyes, none of them happy. "Indeed," he said. "But just enough for an interesting competition, I think." "I don't understand, grandfather." He lifted his hand in a gesture that would have been graceful once. Now his hand shook badly. "It is very simple. I have named three heirs. One of you will actually manage to succeed me. The other two will doubtless kill each other, or be killed by the victor. As for which lives and which die," he shrugged, "that is for you to decide." My mother had taught me never to show fear, but emotions will not be stilled so easily. I began to sweat. I have been the target of an assassination attempt only once in my life, the benefit of being heir to such a tiny, impoverished nation. No one wanted my job. But now there would be two others who did. Lord Rolade and Lady Samina were wealthy and powerful beyond my wildest dreams. They had spent their whole lives striving against each other toward the goal of ruling the world. And here came I, unknown, with no resources and few friends, into the fray. "There will be no decision," I said. To my credit, my voice did not shake. "And no contest. They will kill me at once and turn their attention back to each other." "That is possible," said my grandfather. I could think of nothing to say that would save me. He was insane, that was obvious. Why else turn rulership of the world into a contest prize? If he died tomorrow, Rolade and Samina would rip the earth asunder between them. The killing might not end for decades. And for all he knew, I was an idiot. If by some impossible chance I managed to gain the throne, I could plunge the 100,000 kingdoms into a spiral of mismanagement and suffering. He had to know that. One cannot argue with madness, but sometimes, with luck and the Sky Father's blessing, one can understand it. "Why?" He nodded, as if he had expected my question. "Your mother deprived me of an heir when she left our family. You will pay her debt." "She is 4 months in the grave," I snapped. "Do you honestly want revenge against a dead woman?" This has nothing to do with revenge, granddaughter. It is a matter of duty. He made a gesture with his left hand, and another courtier detached himself from the throng. Unlike the first man, indeed, unlike most of the courtiers whose faces I could see, the mark on this man's forehead was a downturned half-moon, like an exaggerated frown. He knelt before the dais that held Descartes' chair, his waist-length red braid falling over one shoulder to curl on the floor. "I cannot hope that your mother has taught you duty," Descartes said to me over this man's back. "She abandoned hers to dally with her sweet-tongued savage. I allowed this, an indulgence I have often regretted. So I will assuage that regret by bringing you back into the fold, granddaughter. Whether you live or die is irrelevant. You are Ara Mary, and like all of us, you will serve." Then he waved to the red-haired man. "Prepare her as best you can." There was nothing more. The red-haired man rose and came to me, murmuring that I should follow him. I did. Thus ended my first meeting with my grandfather, and thus began my first day as an Ara Mary. It was not the worst of the days to come.
You've been listening to Chapter 1 of The 100,000 Kingdoms, read for you by the author, N.K. Jemisin. Tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI, at 99.5 FM and at WBAI.org for the rest of the universe. This is Hour of the Wolf. My guest this morning, N.K. Jemisin, Nora Jemisin, whose first novel of the Inheritance Trilogy mm-hmm. has just been published by Orbit, mm-hmm. and whose short story, Non-Zero Probability, mm-hmm. has just been nominated for the prestigious Nebula Award. So this is just way cool. And we have been planning for a while to have Nora here this morning, on this morning. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't remember when we first determined this date, but it was half a year ago, right?
I think so. Yeah. It was the second to last Altered Fluid that I think you finally cornered me and said, you're coming on the show.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
And I'm pleased to do it when a person has a novel coming out or anything. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the truth be told, I'm not looking for the publication of something. I'm just looking for a good radio show.
Gotcha.
And but the fact that it came out not only with the novel but mm-hmm. coincided with the nomination is just
that was
yay.
Nice.
Yeah. I think it's the current term is just yay.
Yeah.
So at least it's my term.
I agree wholeheartedly.
Yeah. Indeed. Mm-hmm. Indeed. Mm-hmm. So very heady. Very wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And nice reading.
Oh, thank you.
Let me see.
I have one note for those that may want to read this for themselves. On my website, nkjemisin.com, the first three chapters are posted. So anybody who wants, and these are the pre-copy editing chapters, just a note, but anyone who wants to sample a little bit more before they decide whether or not to buy the book, then you can.
Yeah, and my note to that, screw it, buy the book.
Okay, well, I'm a little biased, but, you know. I feel like people should try before they buy, too.
Yeah, and I say, I've read it.
Gotcha.
I'm telling you, buy the book. You know, okay. That's it. You know, it's like, okay, and you just got a sample, didn't you?
That's true.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, there. At this point, we will invite people to join us mm-hmm. by calling here at WBAI, 212-209-2900. And the rule is the same as always. pertinence, not impertinence, relevance to our guest and to what we are doing this morning. And that's basically it. A lot of what you were first writing, I mean, you're of this new generation of writers. There's actually so many people in Altered Fluid are, late 20s, early 30s group of people.
Right. We got a few 40s, and I think a stealth 50 in there, but they don't tell us.
Yeah. But I think part of what's going on also is, I note when you and I were talking earlier, talking about, well, I went and changed the file.
Yeah, pretty much.
But I think that changes the fiction. I think it's an enabler. I think that people, you couldn't have done that with a typewriter. The book would not have been formed in the same way.
Well, I mean, in this case, the 10 years ago version had been started on a word processor.
Exactly.
And the word processor was such a pain to use that I didn't make many changes to it. And the final version was probably a little bit weaker, not just because I was a 10 years younger writer, but also because I had not been as tweaky with it as you know, computer writers these days are. So, but the second version was done from scratch on, you know, my next to last Mac. Yeah, lots of tweaks.
Yeah. And it's something that the technology enables. I mean, just could not have been done earlier. You know, go back to Jane Austen, where it's all manuscript on paper and very few cross throughs.
Right. Right.
And take it to the modern era. Arthur C. Clarke wrote a wonderful essay called "The Steam Powered Word Processor" about how technology was changing writing, and he was a little bit positive and critical.
In what sense?
He thought that it meant that people could write quicker and without the thinking, without the cogitation beforehand, before they would start typing the words onto paper.
He posit the development of, you know, the ability to edit your words, not just the steam poweredness of it, but the fact that you could back up, cut and paste?
Yes, he did. And you know, he saw positives and negatives. So he was an early adopter. He was one of the first people to say that this is not just a good tool, and in some ways perhaps a negative tool, but it's also it was an observation of how fiction has changed. And I'm thinking, with exception to some of the things that he said in that essay, we're now talking about, well, I was able to change the character. I changed the file. And I'm thinking, that's a technological statement which could not have been done 25 years ago.
Well, just to clarify, I did actually scrap the old file and start over from scratch with writing this one.
So it was a new manuscript.
I could have. It would have been more trouble to try and fix so many things, because I changed, I changed it from third person to first person. I changed it from a fairly didactic, straightforward, this is what happened text to that sort of stream of consciousness, you know, interjections and, you know, using some literary techniques. And I changed the protagonist's personality, who had been sort of, Yana's mother has just died. And so in the original version, I emphasized the fact that Yana was in grieving and mourning more. In this version, I have much more made her snarky or angry to deal with her grief.
Yeah, which is also a mark of the times, I think.
The anger?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think the difference was that in the 10 years since then, I had gone to grad school for counseling psychology and heard about the 12 stages of grief, including anger.
Yes, right.
And so forth. So I am, a lot of times my background as a psychologist does tend to inform my fiction. I don't really intend for it to. But, you know, yes, there's Lou Freud in there and so forth.
We haven't talked a lot. Adler?
No.
Because this is a show started by the granddaughter, all. So.
Yeah. Probably there is some, but, you know, I don't intend to put it in there. I'm not consciously doing it. I just suddenly realize, oh, no, I've got the id, the ego, and the superego.
Yeah. I'm just funning around because I've been in touch with Margot a lot lately. And I'm going to have to drag her back here onto the show. It's been a while since she's done her show.
Oh, that'd be good.
Yeah, yeah, it'd be wonderful. Sorry for those people who called and the phone drops you after about 2 minutes, but back. We still have a number of calls. If you want to speak to Nora Jemison, 212-209-2900. And good morning, you're on the air. Hello.
Yes, good morning, Wolf.
Good morning.
As a 50-year member of a WBAI, Jim and Ms. Jemison.
Jemison.
Uh-huh.
No A.
Jemison?
Jemison, not like the whiskey.
Well, I don't know from the whiskey. Okay, here's a simple question. Has anybody written of the coming revolution in the United States and possibly the world? In the future, let's say, of 2011 or 2012?
It's been done in a number of books, but I can't cite them offhand, but yes.
Well, I mean, there's not one that stays with you? Because Ralph has done a book called Only the Super Rich Can Save Us.
Yeah, but you're onto a political track, Monroe. And
Jim, we're trying to save our own neck.
Okay, but it's not the discussion of a particular science fiction writer this morning, which is what we are here to deal with. But thanks for the call, Monroe. Good morning. You're on the radio.
Good morning, James.
Good morning, Robert. God, do I know all my callers by name?
Yes. Good morning, Miss Jemison. By the way, do you prefer Miss Jemison or Nora?
Nora's fine.
By the way, James.
From you.
Yes, well, considering, James, the weather, you should have played Misty, Moisty Morning or Oh, the Wind and Rain. But anyway, since you're going to be at KGB, Nora, I will save most of my questions.
This Wednesday at 7 o'clock at 85 East 4th Street, is that what you're referring to, along with Michael Shea?
Yes, 85 East 4th Street, west of 2nd Avenue. Yes,
yeah. Yes, thank you. Go to the third floor, admission is free?
Yes.
Is that the thing? Oh, okay.
That's the same place, yes. Below where the Irish step dancing is. Anyway.
Right, yes.
Yeah, which really...
Hopefully they won't do it during my reading.
God. Well,
they usually do.
It's ruined more recordings, let me tell you.
Yeah, well, yeah. They sometimes bring in the Ellen pipes, but that's another story. Nora, I have a question, and I'll save the stock questions for Wednesday.
Sure.
Your title intrigues me, and I want to know, is there any significance to your use of the number 100,000?
I had created this world with the name the 10,000 Kingdoms, thinking that that was, you know, nicely pretentious. There aren't actually 10,000 of them. They just, you know, the Aramari who have taken over this world really are fond of grandiose sounding names. But then I Googled it at one point and realized that basically one of the early iterations of China was called the 10,000 Kingdoms.
Yes,
and
I know.
Like, you know, I'm not going to mooch off China.
No. The reason I ask about 100,000 is because if you're familiar with Irish tradition, in Ireland, when the hero, be he the Jack or the King of Ireland's son, meets the magical helper, be he the sagacious horse, fox, or old woman, if you want to avoid being eaten by the ogre, you say 100,000 welcomes.
Huh.
And it's still done in Ireland. If you meet a friend, you say 100,000 welcomes.
Oh.
Like in Arabic tradition, if you meet the ghoul in the desert, you say something very nice. Oh, grandmother, how nice it is to see you, because if you hadn't, she would have eaten you up.
Really? I had no idea.
So I was just curious. And my last question, and again, I'll save the rest for Wednesday. Sky Father, am I hearing world mythology? Have you dabbled more than I think you have?
I have dabbled.
More than dabbled.
I kind of grew up on various mythologies just because my favorite authors weren't putting out fiction at quite the speed that I wanted, so I started reading people from 2,000 years ago. And I've read quite a bit of mythology from different cultures, and you probably are sussing onto the fact that
a folklorist by profession.
Yes, so you're hearing the roots there.
Yes.
There's a little bit of the Hindu Trimurti.
Yes.
Some of the Judeo-Christian, the Christian Trinity.
Yes. How about African?
Some of that, not as much. There's a little bit of the way in which the Egyptian gods interact with each other,
yeah.
But not that particular, the sky and the earth.
I saw some of the Seth stuff also.
Yes.
Mut and Geb, or Nut and Gub and
yes,
Geb, the
Geb
sky
and, yes.
and the earth, and yes. their fornication produced basically everything.
So does your world have an earth mother?
Yes, there is.
What world doesn't?
I love it.
Yes, the goddess of twilight and dawn is also the god of day and the god of night are the gods of the sky.
The hour of the wolf and the hour between the dog and the wolf. Yes, so that's Jim's specialty.
Oh, yeah, wow. Okay.
That's correct. I'm sure you have other people.
And
one of the great old myths.
I will see you Wednesday night because, as I say, I have many more stock questions to ask.
Sure. Okay, looking forward to it.
Okay, bye. And the telephone number here to talk to Nora Jemison is 212-209-2900. And let me again reiterate, this Wednesday night at the KGB, a fantastic fiction series produced by Matthew Kressel and Ellen Datlow at... I'm saying it right, 85 East 4th Street, but you know what, you go to 2nd Avenue and 4th Street, you walk a little bit west, and you'll see the stairs going up, it'll say KGB Bar. Michael Shea, a wonderful writer who I remember
from years back. World Fantasy Award winning.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to be interviewing him beforehand with a new novel out called The Extra, will be one of the readers, and the other will be N.K. Jemison, who you are listening to right now on Hour of the Wolf. And so see her live and hear more being read. So there's nothing like being there. And so do that. You'll have a great time, I promise you. And let's take another call. Good morning, WBAI. You're on the radio.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Do you have anything to say about when the rest of the two-thirds of the trilogy come out?
Yes. Book two is currently scheduled to come out, I believe, in November of 2010. It's done. It's in the pipe. I just saw the cover art. It's wonderful. Book three is in progress. I just passed the 95,000 word mark.
Wow.
it still has more progress to do and will be very different numbers at the end, I'm sure. But book three is basically almost done.
Do you plan to set any more stories in this universe?
I'm not planning it. I don't say no to the idea. The Inheritance Trilogy is actually a little unusual in that the three books have an overarching sort of thematic link, but they are not the continuing stories or the continuing adventures of Yaina. Yaina's story wraps up pretty well at the end of the first volume.
And yet, you could take this, you've built a world, you've built a wonderful world and mythology in it. Mm-hmm. There could be other complete
stories.
There could
be, yes. Book two takes over with the story of a different character. Book three is another character. I could easily, I suppose, add additional characters.
And there could be short stories. There could be...
Yeah. I'm not fond of the 10-volume trilogy. That is fairly common in epic fantasy. So,
neither am I, but people like what Le Guin will do. She did with it. There was the Earthsea trilogy, but she had the short stories in there that didn't relate to the novels.
Exactly. Yeah.
Have you any other, novels in the works?
I do. I have two other novels that are actually already written in a completely different epic fantasy universe. Those have not sold yet, but I have fingers crossed. That is a duology. That is not a trilogy. I have outlined, but have not actually written a YA novel that I was going to be tackling next, which is actually science fiction. And that one is called Archetype, or at least for now it's called Archetype. I kind of tend to change my titles frequently. So,
thank you very much. I enjoyed your reading.
Excellent.
And you were a very good spokeswoman for your story.
Oh, well, thank you.
Good day.
Thank you.
Have a wonderful day. Thanks for calling. And we have a few more minutes. What's on your show, Simon?
The As I Please Early Morning Radio Alliance Classic Revival
Hour. Ooh, wow. Okay. So everybody put your hand on the radio and get ready.
Okay.
Good morning, WBAI. You're on the air.
Good morning. How are you doing, Jim?
Okay, how are you?
Not bad, not at all. Enjoyed the reading very much.
And no offense to you, but let me just say, women, please call. Okay, go on.
Sorry about that.
I don't not, mind not, men. Not, my not, men are
no,
fine.
No, not your fault. I just like to have a diversified group of callers. That's all.
Great.
These things happen. I'm curious. There was something you said about when you went from thinking, you know, novels to short stories.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I found, I don't really write fiction, but I do some legal writing and some other types of writing,
mm-hmm.
that almost inevitably, when you take things out, it seems to get better. Have you found that, or is that, do you find it that there's like a distillation process? Or
I
is
have.
That just completely very...
No, I found that, you know, having learned to write concisely with short stories, my novels are generally a lot tighter than they used to be. You know, I can write the typical sprawly doorstopper epic fantasy, but I don't really think I need to. I think that I can get the story done in 125,000 words instead of 200,000 words. I see no reason why I shouldn't. I'm an impatient reader myself. I'm the kind of reader who, you know, is like, come on, get to the point, and I write like that. So short stories help me do that.
That's the thing. One of the things when you're writing, be it a business letter or something for political or some type of communicative purposes,
mm-hmm.
a five-page letter has a not good chance of getting read. A 27-page letter has no chance of getting read.
Right.
A page and a half, if you get them interested, then maybe they'll come back for the longer version.
Yeah, yeah.
One thing I've done as an exercise is I'll cut out every third or every fifth word at random and just how few words I can put back in.
Oh, that's a cute exercise, yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that just seems to sharpen the thing up. Now, the other thing was you had mentioned a publication in FNSF, and when was, because I associate your name with them for some reason, and it's a positive association, or was I hearing something wrong?
No, I read FNSF to, for 1 year I had a subscription to FNSF to sort of help train myself to write short stories.
But you haven't yet sold to them?
No, I have not. So I have not had anything published in FNSF.
Yet.
Okay, because I heard you talking about it, and I was curious as to when, because I want to go back through what back issues I have.
No.
Can I ask one question? And ma'am, can I slide off into a slight irrelevancy?
Go ahead.
Sure.
I lost some of my notes, and you had somebody that had, it was about 3 or 4 weeks ago, probably more than that. They had just come out with a Lovecraft fiction anthology or a Lovecraft-inspired anthology.
Ellen Datlow, yeah.
Ellen Datlow. And what was the title?
Lovecraft Unbound.
That's it.
Yeah.
Lovecraft Unbound. Thank you.
Yes.
I had
great anthology.
Move, but I do not live in the best of situations, and my notes had flown the coop, and that had flown the brain. Well, listen, thank you. I will make way, hopefully, for a more diverse section of callers.
Well, yeah, but let's see. Well, we're getting close to out of time, sadly.
Hmm.
Well, let me get quickly out of the way then.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you.
I do that because sometimes when I do that, I all of a sudden get
a bunch of women
callers. And it's very interesting that sometimes they don't call until I ask, and then bang, there they are.
Okay.
So
they're awake this early in the morning. I'm
strong
women.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, actually, we're in primetime radio now.
Oh, wow.
Near drive time, even on a Saturday.
Hmm. Okay.
And which is why we have to remind people constantly that what you're listening to is WBAI in New York and WBAI.org. And that this is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. My guest is N.K. Jemison. J-E-M-I-S-O-N.
S-I-N.
S-I-N. You see, I did it.
It's all right.
I did it. I've got a terrible cold this morning, and my brain is as if I were, let's just say my mind isn't fully here, all right?
Right. Gotcha.
I don't want to say anything on the air. That would bring cops down on me. And the book at hand is from Orbit Books.
Mm-hmm.
It's the first of a trilogy, but reads as a complete novel.
It can stand alone, and book two can stand alone.
Yeah, and it's called The 100,000 Kingdoms, and it's highly recommended, and it's in trade.
Yes, trade paperback.
Trade paperback.
It is coming out in mass market, though, again.
Oh, when is that going to happen?
In fall, I believe, 2010.
Cool. So within a year, that's that's good.
Yep.
That's very good.
And it's available here in the UK, all English-speaking markets at this point.
Right. And
also France, Germany, and Poland.
Wow.
Yeah.
And it's heady. Yeah. It really is. Yeah. And her Nebula Award-nominated story...
Non-zero probabilities.
See, I got it right before. Is available online at clarksworld.com, mm-hmm. yep. which is just a great website anyway. Mm-hmm. And it's a magazine mm-hmm. on the web. It's not fair to just call it a website. It's a magazine.
Right.
And a top magazine as far mm-hmm. as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm.
They run great fiction and podcasts.
Yes, they do. Mm-hmm. They do. And I'll be doing a panel with Neil Clark. At Lunacon this year on mm-hmm. just on pod listening. It's called Listening to Science Fiction on Your Way to Work.
Hmm. Which that's fantastic.
Which is what I hope some people are doing right now. You have to work on a Saturday.
Yeah.
And go to nkjemison.com for mm-hmm. all things Nora Jemison. Mm-hmm. And that will have links to stories, many of which are online.
Yep. Almost all of my short stories are online.
Cool.
Pretty much the only one that is actually not yet published, but it's going to be published in the Postscripts anthology in the UK from PS Publishing. And it's an urban fantasy story like Non-Zero Probabilities, but that one is set in New Orleans immediately after Hurricane Katrina.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
And there's a whole anthology to come there, isn't there?
Actually have been a few. Several.
Yeah.
But I think the Postscripts is not focusing on that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Very well. So thank you so much. This was wonderful. This will not be the last time.
Okay.
And, everybody, you can visit not only nkjemison.com, but you can also visit ourwolf.com, mm-hmm. which will eventually get updated. Mm-hmm. And thank you all for listening. Oh, and next
week.
Thanks for having me. Next week. Ha ha. Okay. I mean, I'm starting the theme in the background, but no, everybody, that we only do highbrow speculative fiction here, which is why next week we have Chicks Who Dig Time Lords.
I love it.
Okay. That's it. Chicks Who Dig Time Lords. That's highbrow as far as I'm concerned. So tune in next week. We'll see you then. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for having me, Jim.
Thank you, Nora.
Love will wing for me. Good morning. Welcome aboard. Yes, good morning. What's happening now? And welcome to As I Please for this, the 13th day of March in the year 10. And there was a great deal of excitement here at WBAI this morning. When I arrived, Max came out and told me there was a big box for me. And I said, a big box? And he brought it out, and it was wrapped in paper, but no postage, meaning that it was delivered by hand and foot. Max said, well, we want you to go into the back room and open it because who knows, but it might be a bomb. I said, who would want to bomb me for crying out loud? He said, more than you imagine. But I said, well, how could a bomb make it into WBAI for crying out loud? What about the building security? He said, building security doesn't go that way. But, you know, these are just part, you know, the price of our times. We're suspicious of everything. But I, having an open heart, and a weak mind, I said, ah, to heck with it. So I ripped open the box. And, you know, I was thinking maybe I should reenact all of this on the air, but it made quite a mess. Although, I gotta say, it came with this stuffing, this sort of packing material, that apparently is cornstarch or something. It looks like peanuts, but you can just wash it down the sink. And even before Jim came on the air, we were all standing around the utility sink in the so-called staff lounge, washing these cornstarch peanuts down. And going, whoa, look at it go, look at it go. However, that's neither here nor there. A little fun here at WBAI. I open up the package and, you know, spread all this packing material around and withdrew a glass orb. It's sort of like a fishbowl. And in the center of it, there is a little contraption. In fact, an oil lamp. And reading the instructions, this is what it tells you. It says, this is a means to create more light. And what you do is you fill this bowl about halfway with water, which I have done. And then you light the lamp within. Now, this packet, by the way, I just want to tell you something. Whoever sent this to me was no cheapskate. This must have been maybe $15 or $17 worth. I mean, this is really quite a very nice little thing here. It's no Weber gift, I'll tell you that much. I don't know whether Weber is still in business, but when we were at 505 8th Avenue, many, many years and many, many years ago, downstairs there was this discount shop called Weber's. And, you know, when WBAI did their, you know, secret Santa crap, you could always tell the Weber gift. Yeah, you could tell. It's just so chintzy. So I'm just pleased to say that this anonymous donor, apparently responding to my fervent pleas for more light in Master Control, I found this perhaps at a museum shop or something like this. So you fill this with water. And now I have filled the little lamp inside with oil. Yes, it's a little oil lamp. I hope it's whale oil, but I suppose that would be going too far. Yes, one of these days I'll go up to the Inuit Nation and come back with whale oil for my hurricane lamps. Is there any other beast that also serves as fuel other than the whale? I'll ponder that on my own time. So, this is it. Now, this fishbowl with a little oil lamp within, and it has three thongs attached to a hook. So, while Jim's theme was on, Ken Gale, the incomparable Ken Gale, came in with the official WBAI drill. And while Jim was packing up and saying goodbye and all that, Ken, in two shakes of a dead lamb's tail, in less time than it takes to tell it, reached up and put a little hole in our ceiling. Yes, he drilled right through the dreaded asbestos padding, which keeps this station, keeps this master control room warm, snug, and cozy. He drilled right through it, inserted a little plug, and then put in a hook. And so I am pleased to say that in a moment I am going to light this lamp and hang it from the hook overhead and see whether it is as they claim, that it will provide enough light to brighten any room. So let's see now. Shouldn't be too hard. Yep, just within reach. And there it goes. Hey, let's see what it's like with the lights off, shall we? Hey, well, why not? Why not? I'll be right back. Let's turn off the lights. Wow. Man, that's really nice. There's a slight flicker. A slight flicker. I don't think that it'll be... I think when the wick gets established, that'll probably take care of itself. But it's sort of a warm light. It does indeed shine on my music stand. You know, I just want to say thank you to this anonymous donor. It's sort of heartening to know that after nearly 30 years on radio, someone has actually heard me and realized that for a variety of reasons, a little bit of light can go a long, long way. Oopsie. WBAI vacuum cleaner hasn't proper suction. Yeah, well, I'll try to clean up while the show goes on. Hey there, comrades. How you doing this morning? I hope that you're staying dry and warm. What the hell do I care? What the hell do you care? But, I had a little time off for this week. Well, far too much time off. And I finally saw, almost in its entirety, The Da Vinci Code. And, my dear friends, comrades in literature, comrades in the arts of thinking and listening and viewing and pondering, what a piece of crap. I'm telling you, This is not a really profound critical term, but on the whole, I sort of like Tom Hanks. I don't go out of my way for him, but, you know, there's nothing offensive about him, the way some people might be. And so there was that, you know, as Tom